I can have your attention. We have a guest lecturer tonight, as I let you know last week, who we're very fortunate to have with us. Bob Challoner is, among other things, the Chief Executive Officer of Cabrini Hospital here in New York City. He is has the illustrative background of being a graduate of the School of Public Health here at Columbia. He also has an MBA and various other degrees as well. He teaches a class for us in health information technologies, in which one of the things that he does and that I've asked him to think about doing with you guys tonight is think about the new world of health information technologies and what it means and what it's like to manage, you know, and in his case, as the chief executive officer of a hospital here in New York City, to manage in an environment of changing information technologies. And so he'll be talking with us for about an hour or so, and then we'll open up and have some questions from you guys, and then we'll take a break, and you can buy more cookies on the outside in the hallway there. So without further ado, let me introduce Mr. Bob Challoner.
Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me in the back? It's been a long day, and the tree pollen count is up, and my voice is fading. So somebody raise a hand if I get out on this. As Michael said, I 25 years ago, actually, this spring, that I finished this program. And Hammer Health Sciences was brand new at that point, and the innovative building of its time. It's a little interesting to see it a little bit past its prime at this point. It certainly is a pleasure to be back here with you tonight. When Michael actually first talked to me about teaching the course with the executive management program, the goal was to, I mentioned to him that I really am not a technologist. I have some background. I spent about 5 years working with a information technology consulting firm, management consulting firm, doing work with hospitals around the country, but my role has always been in the operations management side of it. And the point really for teaching the course with the EMTH program was less the interest that people had in actually programming and writing programs for hospitals and healthcare, and more from the perspective of what's it like actually managing this resource. Are any of you actually information technology, probably in this age group you all are, much more so than I am, but how many of you are actually involved in healthcare information technology in one sort or another? Show of hands. Anybody actually involved in that today? Okay, so there's only one guy I need to worry about keeping my facts straight with. How many of you are aspiring to be healthcare administrators of one sort or another? Good. Those of you that are the small minority, keep yourselves a small minority. And how many of you are clinicians who are actually pursuing a degree in management because you're trying to understand what the administrators and all the other people around you are trying to do to ruin your lives? Okay. What are the rest of you doing here? You should be here. It's an interesting challenge. As I've spent the last 25 years after leaving the School of Public Health, there have been a couple of recurring themes in my career. One has been a chronic shortage of cash. Healthcare is chronically underfinanced, underfunded, and always in financial crisis of one sort or another. And I remember 25 years ago with the advent of DRGs and thinking that was devastating, never imagining it would be as bad as it is today. So finance has always been a recurring theme, and anybody who has any interest in this field, I would continue to urge you to get a good, strong basis of understanding of finance, financial issues, and management of the financial resources. The other theme has been getting and holding on to good people. Always a challenge again in healthcare. We are constantly competing against other industries, banking, the insurance industry, much snappier, jazzier fields like marketing, law, places where people perceive opportunities to make more money frequently than they do in healthcare, and getting and holding on to talent is probably one of the most difficult challenges of the healthcare manager's job. And just when you think you get somebody good, you have a tendency to lose them to another organization. The third area has been information management. And as I'll talk about tonight, there are numerous challenges with that, especially as a healthcare manager with a broad general management degree similar to what you're getting, trying to understand what all of this is about, what the technology means, and understand the complexities, the interplay of the various people that are involved with it, the programming, the hardware, the software, all of that sometimes seems like a very daunting task. And one of the things I quickly realized, the best thing you can do is not try to understand it. The best thing you can do is try to understand the importance of it and then find the people to help manage it for you and really stay focused on your job as the executive, which is really develop the overall strategy and understand how the resource fits into that overall strategy rather than trying to build it yourself. If you attempt to build and develop the systems yourself, you will fail. Your goal is obviously to find the people, the talent, the money, and bring it all together in a planned, thoughtful way. Tonight, what I'd like to talk to you, a little bit about why the information is so important and why understanding somewhat about the information technology resource in your organization is important to you. Why it's something that you need to assume. Frequently, I know the biggest challenge for me is I moved up the hierarchy. When I first started out in the career, it was very easy to sit at my desk and complain that the information systems were no good. Right? And we all tend to do that. We surround ourselves, we've got the computers, and it's very easy, especially in a big organization, saying, why can't these people get it right? Nothing works here. The email system is always going down. Computer, no one's ever figured out how to back it up. I wish those IT people would come in here and fix it for me. The higher you move up in an organization, the more people are going to come to you and tell you, why don't you get it right? Why don't you get somebody in here who can fix these information resources? Why is it that I'm just trying to do my job and I can't get the computers to work? And what's wrong with this organization? And your role increasingly is less to be the one complaining and identifying and more to be the problem to identify, or the person to identify the way to get some of these problems fixed and find the solutions. And that really does become your challenge. And as you'll see, the opportunities for problems in healthcare information technology are vast, and the solutions are often fraught with many, many problems. And it becomes a real and often hopeless challenge to try and fix some of these things. I'll talk to you a little bit tonight about why I believe the technology is such a mess. And one of the things I've talked about in my other class is if you look at healthcare compared to most industries, information technology is probably the most broken, the most complex, and ultimately the least performing in terms of value delivered for the cost and investment made of any of the industries. And frankly, a very disappointing product that's often produced for most of us in the industry. There's some reasons for that. We'll talk about that tonight. I'll also talk to you a little bit about the historical legacy and how we got to where we are. And then some key principles in your role, and hopefully leave enough time for questions and answers as we get through this. And if somebody, maybe Michael, just give me the high sign if I start to approach an hour. I forgot my glasses, so I can barely see the clock over there. Next slide. Let's talk about why information systems are so important to you as a healthcare manager. Number one, if you think about healthcare, we talk about healthcare, the product is patients. The product is taking care of people, you know, ultimately healing in one form or another. Really, it's about information. And if you think about healthcare, it really is an information-driven industry. The goal in healthcare is to take very bright people, get enough knowledge into their heads, and get the right information to them at the right time so that they can make a decision that will produce a desired effect. And that's an information system. That is a simple definition of what an information system is. An input, a process, and an output. And clinicians, in many ways, are healthcare information systems. They're getting inputs, they're processing it, and they're spitting out an output, which is making recommendations. Frequently, doctors are not even touching the patient, but they're making recommendations. It's almost like they're spitting out some sort of an output that they're giving to somebody else to follow to take a course of action, or that they may be directing themselves to do it, obviously. But if you think of healthcare at its very basic, it really is an information industry. And bad information in healthcare can lead to ultimately disastrous effects. And if you think about all of the other industries that people are involved with, the chance to do harm with bad industry in healthcare, aside from the federal government, is probably the greatest area. Bad information will kill people in this industry. And our role as healthcare managers is to make sure, primarily, that people are not harmed by what we do. So our job from an information perspective is to make sure that good information is available so that people can ultimately be helped and healed by what we're doing. And it doesn't only apply to clinical information. You think about what managers do. I have to make decisions about budgeting and deployment of resources, hiring and firing decisions, and bad information can ultimately produce a bad outcome, which will degrade the output of the organization. I can do tremendous harm not only to the people that are working for me, the doctors that are trying to work at the organization, but also ultimately the community and the people that we're serving. So healthcare is very much an information industry. Good management, as I said, requires good information, and I also think good information is the product of good management. If you look at a poorly run healthcare enterprise, one of the common denominators is a lack of information, information that's not delivered on a timely basis, or information that's just wrong. And frankly, the biggest challenge that I find in healthcare is management by anecdote. We manage by somebody comes running in the hall or some latest crisis that happened over the weekend, and we're suddenly making decisions based on some anecdote that turned into a major crisis in the organization. And that's not good information. And if were I to manage solely based on anecdote, I could have easily destroyed the organization and create a great deal of harm. So my job as a manager ultimately is to make sure that good information is arriving on my desk. There's obviously pressure for improved information growing in society. And we all know that many, many organizations are demanding that hospitals deliver information. The days when you would walk into a hospital or a doctor's office and assume that good medicine was being practiced are over. Patients are very, very skeptical about what we do. Frankly, patients are afraid of what we do, and patients are now armed with information to prove to us that what we're doing is probably wrong, and it's a challenge for clinicians and for managers across the board, and the demand for us to show that we are managing effectively and put good information out for the public is growing each year. Competition in this industry, certainly in the last 10 years, has accelerated to the point where we like to pretend that we're a free market economy. In many ways, we're not. But the need for good information to stay ahead either of the competition, to look for new opportunities, to know which, you know, standalone, for-profit surgery center is eating my lunch as a hospital for surgery, is a challenge for me. And the need for good information to manage competitively in this environment is absolutely growing. Regulation and lawsuits are growing. Tomorrow I'm actually spending about 6 hours with a U.S. attorney relating to a case that goes back to the late 1990s, 4 years before I came back, before I even came to Cabrini. And I am hamstrung in proving a case with this U.S. attorney because we can't get information out of the computer system that existed at that point. Nobody knows how, the computer's still there, nobody knows how to access it at this point. And when they migrated the information or migrated to a new computer system, nobody really planned on what should happen with that old information. So I'm basically sitting in front of the U.S. attorney with crayons saying, I'm a nice guy, trust me. And it's not a very pleasant place to be. And the amount of regulation and oversight in healthcare is growing. And the expectation in the regulators is that you can produce this information, that you have access to. They don't want to hear about your technical difficulties. They want to know that you have an opportunity or that you can get access to this information. Frankly, if they can't, their assumption is you're either incompetent or you're covering something up. So that is a real challenge for us. And finally, the lines are blurring in healthcare. There used to be, there was the computer department that sat, the data processing department that sat up in one corner of the building or down in the basement somewhere, and there were a couple of people that were the data processing people, and they ran around and did everything, and the restriction in data processing was restricted to a few very small functions. And if you look at what's going on in healthcare, everything is becoming an information system. We have IV pumps now that are monitoring vital signs and spitting out reports, and now are being interfaced into our order results reporting system and feeding information directly in. That IV system, that IV pump, is as complicated as any piece of information system we had 20 years ago, 15 years ago. And the need to understand that all of these things are really information systems is a challenge. One of the things we've done in Cabrini in the last couple of years is develop a non-invasive cardiac imaging program, high-powered CT scanner, and brought in a top-notch cardiologist from Mount Sinai who's developed this program, and we're working with Sinai to develop it. And we're all very excited about the fact that we're doing this and producing images of the heart that, frankly, are quite astounding. And one of the things we've got the doctor, we've got the CT scanner, one of the things we didn't really plan on is the fact that this piece of equipment that he's using is really an information system. It's a piece of information technology, and the images aren't being generated the old way through photography. It's a digital image, thousands and thousands of images being generated on each patient. And each patient is generating an image that is so large, one of the things we quickly discovered at Cabrini is we can't move these images through our information network, or the infrastructure connecting all of our computers. The images are too big to move through the image, or move through the network. So despite this great technology, we're currently burning CDs and sneaker netting CDs up and down the hospital, and while we're figuring out a fix for this network. But it struck me that the radiology equipment and the imaging equipment that we are installing in the hospital at this point is really not the old-fashioned photographic equipment. It really is a computer system that's generating a digital image that needs to be managed just like any other piece of digital information, including how to store, back it up, and manage it over time. Next slide, please. It's also very important for us to understand as managers that, like I said, it's not somebody else's problem for a lot of reasons. And there's some challenges for us. Number one, it used to be when I started my career, the hospitals really were the center of the healthcare universe. Hospitals were where it was all happening. And there were some doctor's offices scattered around the periphery, but everything was essentially happening at the hospital. And the information was typically driven by the hospital. And over the last few years, the hospitals are increasingly being driven to the periphery of the healthcare market. And if you think about it, there's so much more happening outside of the hospital at this point. And the challenges that that's creating for information management are great. No longer can we count on the hospital being the sole repository of all healthcare data. Now it may be residing in ambulatory clinics or for-profit surgery centers, or large doctors' group offices, or all of these other types of healthcare entities that are growing and developing the virtual networks between some providers. And so much more information is moving out to the periphery, and I see the need or the control of information in healthcare really is fragmenting. And that fragmentation seems to be increasing, not decreasing, and no longer can we rely on the hospital as the primary driver of that technology. Interestingly, too, some of the information systems development, the more interesting stuff is happening out in the periphery, too. And you can go to some large group practices, and they're much farther along in development of things like an electronic medical record than most hospitals are. The competition for workers is accelerating, and it's another challenge for us. When I started my career, I remember when we got the first PC. I was at Lenox Hill. I did a residency at Lenox Hill. We got the first PC, and the president of the hospital put it on my desk, and he literally said, "You figure out how to use it. You're the youngest person in the office." And I had a great time with it. I really had no idea what I was doing with it, but we were able to create a little database, and I think I was able to show them how I could keep track of the secretary's hours with it. And that was very, very exciting to everybody. As you know, over the last 20 years, the development of PC technology and the proliferation of PC technology, you're podcasting this lecture tonight. I have to ask my kids how to do podcasting. But I can tell you this, that as we're starting to recruit new people into hospitals, the people that are really growing up with this technology, who are the drivers in the next 10 and 15 years of industry, and where the talent is really going to come from, aren't going to want to come to an organization that has a couple of broken down old PCs and a poorly functioning network. Young doctors and residents, one of the first things they ask us is, what kind of order entry results reporting system can I do online dictation? We have our doctors right now, a couple of them are trying to use their BlackBerries to keep track of databases and put in orders. And frankly, are frustrated that the hospital has not yet developed that capability. And if a hospital next door is wowing the same residents with the ability to take their palm device and keep track of patient orders and do it from the movie theater when they should be on call, they're probably going to be a lot more competitive in terms of attracting the talent than I would be. So the ability to keep and hold on to talent will be very much a perception of the ability to develop good information systems. You yourselves know, you walk into an organization in the place that has the nice flat panel screens and the latest technology probably looks a little more advanced and a little more competent than the old hospital with a bunch of broken down PCs sitting around. The other thing that's a big challenge for us in management is your board and your governance. And this is a surprise, because when I sit with healthcare people, when I talk to my colleagues in the industry, and we all bemoan the fact that we have lousy computers, and we all make excuses for the fact that we have lousy computers. And we all say, yeah, and we all understand why we're there, because we grew up in the industry. And it's very easy to sit with those folks and make the excuses and live with it. And then I go in front of my board once a month, and who are my board members? And this is true of most healthcare organizations. My board members are typically bankers. There's a preponderance of bankers on hospital boards. Wealthy businessmen, insurance people, lawyers, people who come out of the private sector. And they are absolutely incredulous that the organization for which they have fiduciary responsibility doesn't have a computer to do basic functions. And I talked to a board member who's a banker, and he says, Bob, I can keep track of all the stuff in the bank on a computer, and you're telling me that patients' vital signs are still being written on a piece of paper? That's inexcusable. And they don't want to hear excuses, because the board has the fiduciary responsibility to make sure that patients are being cared for and the organization is not being sued and that the finances of the organization are whole. So my challenge then is, one, to educate the board where we are, and two, is try and help them along in terms of helping me get to the point of developing that. But I can tell you, boards, especially in these post-Enron days, are very interested in what your information systems are capable of, what kind of information you're storing, how long you're storing it, and what's the integrity of that data over time. And your job as the manager isn't to tell the board, the worst thing I could do is tell my board, you know what, board, we couldn't bill last week because I inherited these crappy old information systems. The board's going to look at me and say, you're a bozo, get out of here, you're fired. The board is going to say, your job's to get it fixed. And that really is what our job is to do. It's to figure out not why we have the problem, but ultimately to come up with a solution for that problem. Despite all of the negative stuff, I have to tell you that I find the challenge of fixing the information systems in healthcare one of the more stimulating challenges. I haven't figured out how to do it, but it's certainly very stimulating, and it is something that I would recommend all of you to pay attention to. And don't think it is something, well, I'm not an information systems person, so I'm gonna stick it in the desk or worry about that. I'm gonna put it into the hands of the IT folks. Make it something that you're interested in your careers and pay attention to in your career. It will pay off over time. If you're able to speak the language a little bit, you're able to understand the problems, and you're able to help direct the organization forward in terms of development of its information resource. Any questions so far? Good, because I don't have questions. No, I'm kidding. Any questions at any point? Just a couple of core concepts. Number one, like I said, healthcare really is an information-driven industry. The challenge of getting good information, not data. Data is what we are surrounded with, and I am inundated with data. Really, it's called garbage every day. With reports that flow into my office, usually somebody CCing me because they want to get a few brownie points and prove to me how wonderfully they've written a report that gets shipped into my office or on my email every day. And most of it is completely meaningless to me and completely worthless to me as a manager. The trick for me is to figure out how to get good information showing up on my desk, depending on whatever it is I'm confronted with. If my job is to balance the books that week and figure out a way to drop our FTE count, because our census has declined, and my challenge is to get good information about payroll and data. I really don't need all of the other stuff flowing in. So defining what is, just because it's showing up on a green bar or a piece of paper or on an email, doesn't necessarily mean it's anything other than just data. As I said, it will become increasingly critical for you over the next, over the course of your careers. And I'll also talk a little bit about why healthcare is so different and why I think the challenges are so different in healthcare. The other thing I've learned is there is no wrong way or right way to doing it. I know I spent almost 6 years of my career with a healthcare management consulting firm, started as an associate and ended up as a principal with the firm. And it was a New York-based firm, and they decided that I was the only one that didn't have a New York accent in the firm, so they shipped me to hospitals all over the country, all the little hospitals in South Carolina and Kentucky, and I got to see America in those 6 years when I really wanted to stay home in New York. But what was interesting to me was that as many hospitals as I saw, there were as many mistakes using the same systems. And there were as many hospitals using, one hospital I see a system that was a complete mistake and not working, and another hospital I find the same solution working perfectly well. And Hospital A talked about how they couldn't wait to rip this piece of junk out. Hospital B was talking about how wonderful the system was and volunteering to do infomercials for the vendor that sold them the computer system. And what was striking to me about it was it wasn't so much the software that they bought, but it was the way that they implemented the software and the way that they adapted it to their own organization and recognized the unique and complex or unique characteristics of their organization. And the good systems were systems where somebody understood how that organization was different and what they needed to do differently in terms of buying, installing, implementing, and managing the system over time. And there was no right answer. And it was always a challenge, because as a consultant, if any of you go into consulting, the big challenge is everybody expects you to show up, fly in from out of town, and you have the answer. You're going to tell them how to put in a computer system that works. And the big disappointment is that really there is no single answer in most of these things. Your job really is to guide the client through the selection process and finding a solution that will work for them and understanding that there is no right answer, there is no one single solution that fits all in this industry. I also think that one of the biggest challenges for us in the field is to try and talk the talk intelligently but not get so immersed in it that we look like fools. I meet with my chief information officer about once a month, and he gives me an update on what's going on, what's happening with the system. And early in my career, I was very intent on proving that I knew this stuff. And so I would throw out terminology that I really didn't have a clue what it meant, but I read it in one of the journals a couple weeks before. And it didn't take me too long to realize that the people that really do knew it thought I was a jerk. You know, he's talking the language, and they're nodding their heads because I might have had a little more authority. But I wasn't creating a sense of respect with them, certainly, by pretending to know it. If anything, they're walking out saying, well, this guy thinks he knows what he's talking about, but we're going to pull the wool over his eyes anyway. And they really did most of the time. Much more effective, I found, was just admitting, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, you come here, and I've had the information managers that walk in, they start talking about gigabytes and terabytes and networking protocols and ISDN and all of these various standards. And I have to, the most important lesson I learned was not to sit there and nod knowingly like I knew what I was talking about and I really didn't, but was to stop them then in their tracks and say, I don't know what you're talking about. You've got to explain it in language that I understand so that I can ultimately become your advocate to sell what you're trying to do to other people in the organization. And you have to help talk me through what's really going on here, what's working, what isn't working. I would never presume to sit with a surgeon and talk to him about how to do surgery in medical terminology. I'm not a clinician. I'm not an IT person. I'm not a finance person. Somebody said, well, I had a doctor once say to me, actually, well, what is it you managers are? You're ignorant in everything. I said, well, that's our job, to be ignorant in everything so that we can keep asking you the questions to make sure you're going in the right direction and keep challenging you. And really, with information technology, unless you're like our friend up in the back here who has a background in it, don't try to pretend. Recognize you don't know the stuff. Ask the questions and ask people to translate. And also you tend to find people love to explain. They really do like to explain. And it's a good opportunity to get to know the people that are working for you better and hopefully get them to talk through the problem to see whether or not they've got a grasp of what's going on as well. A couple facts and figures. It's a big business, healthcare information technology in this country. This figure is about a year old, so it's probably escalated another $5 billion or so. But it's about $23 billion that most the provider community is currently spending, and that's hospitals, doctors, clinics, nursing homes are currently spending on information technology. Large amount of money. 3% of the average healthcare organization's budget is being devoted to healthcare or their information technology resource. 3%. You'll see that's not a lot compared to most industries. It's part of the reason why we have such a problem. Consumes almost 10% of your annual capital budget. That's sort of the hidden thing. People know often what it's costing in terms of salaries. They often know what the one-time cost is. We'll buy the system, it's going to cost us $1 million. But then we forget about the replacements and the add-ons and the things. And ultimately, almost 10% of the annual capital, capital is the kind of one-time money you're spending each year, gets spent in most healthcare information or healthcare organizations on their capital, on their information technology resource. The average community hospital is generating hundreds of thousands of bits of information and reports and transactions. And the moderate-sized healthcare organization has almost 30 separate applications. We talk about the hospital information system. There is no hospital information system. There are hospital system information systems, plural, that are trying to do everything that's going on within the hospital. And that's a small hospital. A place like Presbyterian has hundreds and hundreds of systems that are processing information. But 30 major applications are typically trying to work together within the hospital. And as I said earlier, they're no longer the sole domain of healthcare of hospitals. A lot of the development and a lot of the interesting stuff in healthcare right now is really happening outside of hospitals. There are real risks too today. It was 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, you could mess up your information systems and not subject your organization to a lot of risk. The biggest risk always was not being able to bill, and it may create financial crisis. From a regulatory perspective, very few risks associated. We do have real risks and penalties. Failure to safeguard your information, the HIPAA standards can result not only in organizational fines, but personal fines, and ultimately imprisonment. So it's something we need to worry about. I sometimes feel like the role of the government in healthcare right now is to make sure we all go to prison. And I'm modeling striped shirts these days a lot. But it is a challenge for us. And the scrutiny and the regulation around the management of healthcare resource, because we didn't do such a good job of it in the past, is important to us and subject to a high degree of regulatory oversight. The biggest challenge today is, as I said earlier, is what I perceive as the failure of information technology to deliver on its promises. In the early 1990s, there was tremendous hype about the integrated delivery network, an integrated delivery system, and there would be no more bricks and mortar in healthcare. We would move to virtual healthcare organizations, and the power of networks and the internet and computing would eliminate the old-style hospital. And suddenly we would be free from the buildings, and we would move to healthcare organizations built around information systems. Then a lot of those companies went bust with the internet and the crash of the internet, the dot-com crash in the late 90s. And then we spent virtually every dollar we had left trying to prepare ourselves for the year 2000. And today, hospitals are, the information systems resources are in almost as big a mess as they were 10 years ago. And there's a tremendous sense of disappointment in the industry, despite all of the spending over the last 10, 20 years. What the systems have actually delivered is really not much greater than it ever was. And there's still tremendous problems in healthcare. Most of the data, and a couple examples, most of the data is still paper-based. No hospital in this country has yet made the leap to a completely paperless medical record. And every time I've made that comment, I've had a couple people say, that's not true. It is true. If you go into the industry and you talk, that no hospital has yet freed itself of a paper-based medical record for a lot of reasons. Some of those reasons are clinicians don't want to give it up. I think the biggest reason is nobody's developed something yet that works as efficiently as the medical record, the paper-based medical record. It's hard to find a system yet that will open itself as easily, that can be scanned, that can be used by so many different specialties, and frankly can be safeguarded as easily as that paper-based medical record. And today, no organization, hospital, has yet to develop that. Other organizations have. A lot of big ambulatory practices have developed an electronic medical record. Some of the nursing homes have developed an electronic-based medical record. And part of that, we'll get into in a little bit. Data retrieval, yet, despite networking technology, despite advances of the internet, it remains extremely cumbersome and difficult, slow, and a tedious process. And I don't know, in a hospital where you walk in yet and everybody's saying, wow, I can get every piece of information I want as quickly as I want it, especially clinical information. And there's some real differences between the clinical and financial information that is available to you online. And again, part of that we'll talk about. Users across the board, if you walk in any hospital, talk to the users, the people that are sitting in front of the terminals, whether they're clerks, whether they're doctors, whether they're nurses, there's an almost palpable anger about the computer systems in place in healthcare today. Every time I walk the floors at the hospital, I will invariably be stopped by someone, usually a nurse, saying, you know what, I hate this thing. It's creating more work for me than the old record. Why do you need it? And that's true in every hospital you walk into today. There's just almost an anger about the systems and how they're not really making our jobs easy. They're making our jobs more difficult. I would disagree with them in many ways. I mean, people are using email very effectively. People are generating word processing documents. People are generating analyses of data from some of the databases much easier, but that's not what they're perceiving. In terms of its ability to do what they do, whether it's charting, whether it's medication ordering, is much more difficult in many people's eyes. And consumers are frustrated, and that's another challenge for us. Consumers are frankly frustrated with the fact that they can't get their information. Try calling a hospital billing office and get a hold of someone who can talk to you intelligently about what's on your bill. Try getting your blood test result quickly. Try getting an x-ray interpretation sent from your hospital to your doctor. It's very difficult, and consumers don't understand, why is it I can go to any other, and I can get online and I can book a flight to Bali, but I can't get my hospital to send my blood test result to my doctor who happens to be in the same building. It's a real challenge for us. And it's very, very frustrating for consumers. And it's creating a sense of not only anger, but a sense of that healthcare providers, frankly, that we're incompetent. You know, we can't get basic information about our health to our providers. What does that mean about what we're really doing at the hospitals? That must mean the surgeons don't know what they're doing either. That must mean the nurses don't know what they're doing. And we're being painted with the same broad brush of incompetency, often because our information systems are projecting such a poor image for the rest of the organization. It used to be you walked into a hospital and if it was clean was important, whether the staff were friendly was important, and whether or not the doctor was approachable. Those were the big threes of healthcare. As consumers are becoming more and more dependent on their computers and using the internet to do everything, they're also looking at our information systems and wondering how easily they can retrieve information from their healthcare provider. Let me just read to you a couple of comments, and let's talk about why healthcare is in such a mess. And just contrast these comments. Bank customer. I love my bank. There's an ATM on, this is a little bit hyperbole. There's an ATM on every corner. My statement shows up at about the same time every month. I've never seen a mistake on my statement. They send me a cool triple platinum ATM card automatically every time it expires. Now I can use it as a debit or a credit card. I never need to waste time waiting for a teller. And now I can even bank at home. I worry about the confidentiality of my financial information, but I trust my bank. They virtually eliminated all of the paper in my statement, and I won't bank anywhere else. You're pretty good. And most of us, if you think about it, I've had a couple problems in my life with my bank statements. Tiny. I bank at Commerce, the bank that's all over the place. And I love the fact the ATMs are there, and I never have to find time. I can do it all online. Love it. Commerce looks great. And even when you go into the bank, they've got sleek black flat panel screens on the desk. It just looks good. Let's contrast it with a hospital customer. Why can't my hospital get it right? They ask me the same information 15 times. It takes forever to register for a simple lab test. I got a bill 6 months late, and it's all screwed up. Why am I getting separate statements from all these doctors? They gave me an ID card, but they never use it. I think it's just a public relations gimmick. They better not share my information or I'll sue them. Why do they still do everything on paper? Next time I think I'll try that new surgery center that just opened up on the corner. How many of you had an experience with a hospital bill or hospital information system? Show of hands. How many of you are happy with the experience you had with the paper you received from a hospital? Show of hands. How many of you have had experience with your bank statements? How many of you are having overwhelming problems or really unhappy with the bank statements in the paper that you're getting? Big difference. And if you think about it from the consumer's perspective, the bank's managing the money, the hospital's got the ability to kill me. So it's a big concern, right? Creates a little bit of credibility. Problems. Let's talk about some of the differences, some of the similarities, first of all. And we could say, well, there's a lot of differences, but there's also some similarities. Number one, if you look at your bank, it's processing a vast number of transactions, one of the largest number of transactions of any business in the country is banking. Huge, vast number of different things going on in the bank. Similar to a hospital, huge number of transactions. Hospital's not that different. Multiple locations, banks managing many, many different locations, especially with the advance of all the little ATMs all over. Hospital, frequently many locations. Complexity issue, but banking seems to get it right. Banking is as heavily regulated as healthcare. In fact, many of the rules we're living with in healthcare, including HIPAA, have evolved out of banking regulation. So also similarity, and yet banking seems to have dealt with it. We worry about our privacy concerns in healthcare. We also worry about our privacy concerns in banking. We don't want people to know we've got some communicable disease, nor do we want somebody to know our bank balance. Intense privacy concerns in both industries. Many unskilled employees in both industries managing the information systems. And if you think about it, the people that are keying the information, you go into a hospital registration office, probably a clerk with a high school education that's responsible for gathering that information, putting it into the system for you. Same thing with the teller in the bank. Most of the overwhelming number of employees in the bank are no better educated than the people that are doing a lot of the basic data entry in the hospital. There's growing consumer pressures in both industries for convenience, speed, and accessibility. If you think about it, we wouldn't go to a bank that didn't have ATMs. We probably wouldn't go to a bank that hadn't automated its statement. And many of us wouldn't go to a bank that didn't offer an online banking feature at this point. So the idea of accessibility is equally important in both. Consumers are looking for the same thing in healthcare as well. Both highly competitive. Banks are everywhere. Banks on every corner, ATMs on every corner, they're all competing for your business. Hospitals are running into the same problem. Used to be the hospital, but now we do have all the little separate ambulatory centers, surgery centers, doctor's offices, all competing to do the same thing the hospitals used to do. And the other striking similarity when you think about it is they're managing a basic human need. It doesn't get much more fundamental than money and healthcare. Maybe food is the other one. And I'd argue that even the restaurants seem to be doing a better job of automating than the hospital these days. So very tremendous number of similarities. You could argue, well, maybe that's what's going on in the hospital? Despite the similarities, there are a couple things that are fundamentally different that I think it's important for all of you as you move into the field of healthcare management to understand the challenges that you're up against within healthcare. Number one, the bank has vast number of transactions, so do the hospital. But despite the vast number of transactions, the type of transactions are very, very different. Banking, most transactions are very, very similar. Put your money in and take your money out. I'm oversimplifying, but it's basically putting the money in, taking the money out, and doing some accounting for it. Hospitals, when you think about the average person that goes into it, the number of different transactions, you're gathering financial information, you're gathering basic demographic information, you're gathering laboratory information, radiology information, you're storing notes. The information that's being generated is far more complex, and there's many more different applications for that information than there is in banking. So while both of them share a similarity in terms of numbers of transactions, healthcare is much more complex in terms of the variety of transactions that are being gathered. The other thing that, in terms of those employees that we talked about, you know, again, without oversimplifying too much, but who works for banks? Bankers. I mean, it's tellers, bankers, and a few other general accounting people. It's a pretty homogenous group of employees when you think about it, in banking, who approach the world from a similar mindset. Healthcare is completely the opposite. Healthcare, and people have said to me, you know, your job is really like being the mayor of a small town. And it really is. I'm working with, you know, very low-skilled people all the way up to very highly skilled people. And people who are approaching the same industry from a completely different perspective. I can tell you my CFO looks at a patient completely differently from the cardiologist that I was talking about. And within a hospital and within any large healthcare organization, you have communities of users of information, user communities of information that are very different and have different needs and are looking at the information and ultimately what the organization does differently. The other difference is when you approach your bank, you're typically doing one transaction. When you go up to your ATM, what are you doing? You're getting out cash. Maybe you're going to do a transfer at the same time and a deposit, so maybe three different transactions. Pretty simple in terms of what you're doing. Check yourself into a hospital. The number and type of transactions that you are actually involving yourself in are many, many, many. Each blood test is its own transaction. The surgery that you get ultimately is its own transaction. The billing, that process that you're going to go through, is its own transaction. And all of the outputs that you're looking for in that introduction into the hospital is far more complex and far more varied than it would be if you were walking into your bank. The other difference, which is starting to change a little bit in healthcare, but in banking, typically the rules are very clearly articulated on how to do the business for many years. The general accounting principles have evolved over many years, and banks are all expected to follow these rules, and the regulatory rules that banks need to follow are very, very well defined for virtually every type of transaction. Not so true in hospitals. We're starting to see it, like I said, HIPAA, some of the quality monitoring, some of the other things that are happening in healthcare But the rules for accounting for clinical results and from an information systems perspective have never really been defined. You go from state to state, some of the rules around the storage of information are very, very different. Some parts of the hospital, there are no rules for how long the information needs to be stored, what format it needs to be produced in, and how it needs to be reported over time. Banking recognized very early on that it needed to automate. And the core business of banking, the management of dollars and the management of financial transactions, started really back in the early 60s and the 50s. And there's a long evolution of the systems. In healthcare, the only systems that have that track record are the systems that moved over from banking, which are the financial systems. Clinical systems have only started to evolve in any real way in the last 15 to 20 years and don't have the track record or the time to really mature and develop that we've seen in many of the banking systems. Banking has also spent a lot of time researching the infrastructure that's going to be required to support it. By infrastructure, I mean the size of the equipment, the networking infrastructure, the storage technology. All of this is something banking has paid attention to, partly out of the need to regulate and provide backup. In hospitals, it's tended to be something we do almost as an afterthought. We buy the system, and then we figure out what we need to run it on. And there hasn't been the same kind of research. Another big difference, probably the biggest difference. Banks typically spend almost 30% of their annual operation spending on information systems. Hospital, I told you earlier, 2 to 3%. 3% is considered a lot these days in healthcare to be spending on information systems. A bank would laugh at that figure. And obviously, you get what you pay for. Spend 3% of your budget, you're going to get a product of about 3% of your budget. There's also a real senior executive level focus in banking. And talk to most bankers, they have a sense of what their systems are, they know how much they're spending, they know what the future is, they have a sense of the strategy that they're putting in place to continue to grow and develop the information technology. And I'll tell you, most hospital administrators don't have a clue. The IT people worry about that. I don't need to worry about it. I have a little bit of background in it, so I pay some attention to it, but honestly, I can tell you I don't pay nearly as much attention to it as probably my banking colleagues would pay. And if you treat something as unimportant, it will become unimportant. And that is what we've seen in many, many hospitals. In banking, there's a sense that information technology is seen. It's critical to their strategic success. Commerce Bank, the look of those computers, every Commerce Bank has the same black flat panel screen sitting on the desk in approximately the same position. They've developed software, the ATM is consistent look and feel to it. They've recognized that information technology is not only a strategic asset in terms of managing the information, but it's a marketing asset to them, and it's important to their overall image. Hospitals and healthcare, we tend to see the information system still as a necessary evil. Very few have adopted the idea that information technology is a competitive driver. It drives the core business of banking. The core business is the financial management, and the systems were developed to drive the core management. In healthcare, the systems were developed not for the core business. In healthcare, all of the systems that we're living with today, or virtually all the systems we're living with today, were not built for what we do, which is the clinical care. They were built to do what? To bill. To capture better demographic information and produce a bill. Not our core business. Obviously important to our core business, but the first systems and the basis for all of the systems that we've seen put in the last 20, 30 years started with billing systems. And the clinical applications were added on later and are still being added on. And in banking, it started from the other perspective. It started, we need something to support the core business. There's a very high priority placed on speed, reliability, and cost-effective investment. Banking has a good sense of what it takes, to what kind of return on investment they want, in terms of new systems that are applied. They have a good sense of we want speed, we want reliability. If the system crashes, the bank will be in catastrophe. You know, they have access to all of the electronic transfer funds. You would have a major catastrophe with the bank. They have a real sense that this is a problem for them. Most healthcare administrators worry about it a little bit, but I don't think they've ever paid as much attention to it as their colleagues and executives in the banking industry have. In fact, the number of failures, catastrophic failures of systems going out or systems evolving and not having good access to historical information in healthcare are many, many. Banking also tends to make a decision more on what is the return on investment. And when you think about healthcare decision making frequently, healthcare is very politically driven. And I can't tell you the number of systems I've seen bought, not because it was going to produce a return on investment or because somebody identified certain metrics that needed to be met or satisfied before the system was selected, but because some doctor walked into some CEO's office and started slamming their fist on the table and saying, I want this system. Why, doctor? Because my nephew is selling it. And unfortunately, that's an exaggeration, but it happened. And a lot of the system selections in healthcare aren't driven so much by a business analysis, but are still being driven by a political analysis. What will make the most number of people happier? What will offend the fewest number of people? And every decision around computer systems in hospitals is intensely political. You've got to deal with the doctors who aren't going to be happy, the nurses who aren't going to be happy, and the union that's not going to be happy because you're going to force their membership to change to a new system that they never wanted to learn in the first place. It's also a tremendous historical emphasis in the financial world of recruiting talented IT people, people that really understand this stuff. And the number of MIT-educated IT gurus that are recruited into banking every year at astronomical salaries is great. And people, that's what they look for when they come out of these programs. I'm going to go get a big job in banking, and I'm going to help the bank and investment banks develop this type of IT infrastructure, and that's where the money is. I know of no MIT graduate that's desperate to get into a hospital and start a $40,000 technology job in a hospital. We don't pay the money. We don't seem to want to get the resource to recruit, or to recruit the resources. And again, we end up with a situation where we've got underskilled, undereducated people trying to manage a resource that's critical to our life and death. There's also a real sense within banking of ongoing development. It's something that's worked on every year. There's a plan that's typically put in place. How do we continue to develop the information systems? What is our strategy? How do we continue to improve it? Are we staying ahead of our competitors? What is the investment we're making this year? And I can tell you, information technology in hospitals is usually something that's done once every 3, 5, 7 years. Not something that hits the CEOs or the board's priority list as often as it does within the bank. And there's also a fundamental difference, I think, from the perspective of the consumer. The consumer is, within banking, the customer, and most consumer needs are very, very similar. And it's a real challenge for us. A banking customer, whether it's me or any one of you, we pretty much have the same needs as we walk into the bank. As we walk into a hospital, our needs are very different. If I'm an elderly, demented person with osteoporosis, my needs are obviously very different than someone else, maybe a young person with a hernia or whatever. The needs are very, very different, and the information that will be needed by me and about me and for me is very, very different when you contrast it with the average banking customer. Anyone want to take exception with any of those points? You can see vast difference. Banking is while there's a lot of similarities, healthcare, the challenges and some of the things that are going on in healthcare are very, very different and very challenging. So let's just talk quickly about how we got there. little bit of background. 1960s was really when, and I'll get his slides in case they're hard to, Michael, you can email them out to all of you, but 1960s is when we really saw the evolution of healthcare information systems to begin. The power of the punch cards, early computing technology, and the first significant introduction of computing in healthcare. Anyone know where the other source of healthcare computing other than banking? Some of the early systems. The defense industry. Some of the technology that was developed for missile launching actually made its way ultimately into healthcare systems planning and development as well. The first systems in the 60s were primarily automated office machines to do a few basic things, registration and produce bills. Most of it was homegrown information systems, very few packages available, and it was limited to a few very large university hospitals. And it was also dominated primarily by the hardware manufacturers. And if you think back to the 60s, well, most of you can think back to the 60s, but back in the 1960s, it was the hardware manufacturers, IBMs, the Honeywells of the world, that were really building the software and pushing the software, not so much as a means to solve an application, but because they wanted to sell this hardware that they were developing and realize that we can sell this to hospitals and healthcare organizations other than just banks. And most of the development, as I said, really started in the financial area, payroll and billing. Very little of it had anything to do with clinical needs. The only clinical applications we really saw through the 1960s was in a few research settings where researchers were extracting some clinical data to do some study about, you know, the incidence of a disease in a population group. But very research-driven. 1970s. Very limited introduction of the PC in a few very small settings toward the end of the 1970s. Started to see spread of systems outside of hospitals. The first time we started to see a few nursing homes asking questions like, can we automate our billing system? Can we automate our registration system? And a couple of the large medical practices like the Mayo Group started to automate some of their basic, again, primarily financial information. Start to see the growth of speed and large computer system storage capacity. So rather than just produce a bill, a single transaction, produce it and then dump the information, people started to store the information and keep track of it so that they could trend it over time. And also in the 1970s, we saw the advent of the first commercially available software packages. It was not so much something you didn't have to hire a team of programmers, but the vendors were starting to appear that were selling software packages that you could install. You still needed a big team of programmers to actually make them work. But for the first time, starting to see a little bit of freedom from the hardware manufacturer and movement away from having an in-house programmer. Again, there was primarily information systems being developed for financial applications, but a little bit more growth beyond basic billing and registration, inventory, and general accounting functions. Some of the clinical departments in the 1970s that started to develop systems were some of the specialized areas of the hospital, pharmacy, radiology, laboratory, where you tend to find people who are not so technology adverse to begin with, and started to try to play with some of the technology that's available. And technicians would get a hold of one of these new crude PCs or mini computers and start to develop some automation around specific functions within those departments. And starting to see the emergence of network technology. By the 1980s, we saw the growth of the personal computer, PC software computers starting to appear in hospitals, starting to pop up on desks, primarily for word processing, spreadsheet use. Rapid growth in the 1980s. By the mid-1980s, everybody and their brother was trying to get into healthcare computing and developing software packages that they could sell to hospitals and large medical groups. Primarily fueled by the fact that we moved away from the huge data processing operations and mainframes that required a room this size or bigger, and started to see the advent of the mini mid-range computers that required a lot less space and also became based on operating systems that had open source code where people were able to actually get into them and do programming, not just the hardware vendor.
It was also in the 1980s that we saw the first real introduction of clinical systems. And the first clinical systems were order entry. Put in order, rather than fill out a piece of paper, do this lab test on this patient, key that into the computer, order the test, and then result coming back. NYU was one of the earliest sites to adopt that here in the city. And that was really the beginning of that period for development of clinical information. And springing off of that, software vendors started to develop other things, including the concept of actually retaining this information and start to automate the electronic medical record. In the 90s, by the 90s, all of us had PCs in our homes, and the general population, and more importantly for hospitals and the healthcare institutions, the workers started to become more familiar with it. Up until the 1990s, to put a computer in front of somebody's desk was a major change in their life. Here's a computer, you're going to use it. It's scary, most people, really, up until the 1990s in healthcare, especially clinicians. Very few nurses knew how to turn it on and wanted to turn it on. Same thing with doctors. By the 90s, people were playing around with their PCs at home and were starting to ask the question, feel a little more comfortable. Why can't I get access to this technology at work? With that, we saw some of the commercial packages really proliferate. In the 90s, we saw the introduction of certain standards. Previously, IBM would develop a system, Unisys would develop a system, Digital Computer would develop a system. Nothing really interrelated. To make one system talk to another system took a tremendous amount of programming and investment. And by the 90s, we saw the development of a couple organizations saying, this doesn't make sense. I want to be able to buy this system for my laboratory, this system for my admitting system, and I want them to be able to talk together, and let's create standards that will allow the information to flow evenly across all of the systems. And we saw the development of certain standards, including HL7, which really was the fundamental standard allowing systems to talk to each other. Big step forward in the 90s because it meant that we were no longer so bound to one particular equipment vendor, one particular software vendor, or one group of programmers. We saw in the 90s the dot mania and the dot mania crash, the internet crash. That happened in healthcare as well. We saw a tremendous rise in popularity in internet-based software. That was the future. And by the end of the 90s, it was dead. There were a tremendous number of internet vendors in healthcare that had gone out, sold their stock, made a fortune, and collapsed. And as I said earlier, the focus became more on suddenly the realization that the year 2000 was coming and all of our systems are going to be in trouble, so we've got to spend our money there. We also saw in the 90s a real proliferation of non-hospital-based systems. Computers moved out of the four walls of the hospital into the community-based organizations. And a lot of talent moved into those organizations also. People discovered it's a lot easier to automate a large doctor office than it is a hospital, so let me develop really good applications for the large medical group than the large hospital. And the other thing that started to happen in the 90s was some of the interesting technology around linking the equipment, the actual equipment that may be doing lab processing or creating images in radiology to the information systems themselves. So rather than the lab test spitting out a little piece of paper that somebody needs to go over and key into the results reporting system, we saw the laboratory system for the first time actually able to feed that information directly. And radiology systems, imaging systems, the ability to move an image back and forth across these systems as well. And today, we're seeing a couple of other trends. You all, the Gen Xers, are moving into management in a consumer society. People that grew up with technology and really have a real demand for technology and are expectations that their hospitals and their healthcare providers are able to do stuff with information that an earlier generation didn't expect. I remember the days when we weren't billing and nobody questioned it. In fact, they were frankly, they didn't get the bill. Today, people are wondering why they're not getting the bill and why can't they access the bill online. We get more and more patients asking, why can't I see my bill online? And it's in any other industry, you would think it would be a necessity. In healthcare, it's a virtual impossibility. hardware is no longer the driving force. We really don't care who the label is on our PC. We don't care who the label is on our mid-range computers running our network. Hardware is a commodity. And the expectation is that we can run the systems on whatever hardware is cheapest at this point. Seeing a tremendous spread of microprocessors beyond computers, and it's just astounding to me where the information systems development is in healthcare right now. I talked about the IV systems and some of the capability of the microprocessors, the smart bed technology now that's monitoring patients' temperature and weight. The smart cars, we're in a project with Mount Sinai where people will have these little cars, which I hope will be more than a marketing gimmick, but with their EKG and some of the other stuff embedded in a microprocessor on this car that they will carry around and be able to move their medical record with them. But the advent of the spread of the microprocessor beyond the computers into all of the other technology that we're using in healthcare is creating some tremendous opportunities. Wireless technology is really one of the greatest things happening in hospitals right now. Trying wiring a hospital and keep on top of that wiring, and also just after you go through and pull all the cables, the Joint Commission comes in and realize you punched holes in all your firewalls. It's a real challenge to try and maintain that communication network. And the advent of the wireless technologies and the ability to free ourselves from the shackle of the wire and move the system to the patient and to the people using it is a very exciting opportunity for us. We are seeing the advent today of web-based medicine and smart consumer, obviously. The number of people that want to get access, the people that are shopping online for results and want to know, if I've got a cancer, especially in cancer, we find people shopping all over the world to find the best specialists, and they want to know what the results were, what the survival rates are. More and more, we're seeing the industry being driven in that direction. And as I said earlier, and I believe this, that hospitals are really continuing to move to the periphery, not only in terms of where healthcare is happening, but also in terms of the development of the information technology in this industry. A couple of just points, and I want to leave these with you, and I'll open it up to some questions. The legacy, and what has all of this history left us with? Number one, and the biggest challenges for us, is that the development of healthcare systems are still largely driven to support the original financial applications. I'd like to say that the systems that we have in place today are really exciting from a clinical perspective. Frankly, they are really, really disappointing still. And the real stuff, the systems that are working today, tend to be the financial systems. And the systems that are evolving, continuing to evolve and becoming more stable, are the financial systems. Not our core business, but essential to our core business. But we are left with that legacy that we're still trying to build systems to fit these old financial systems. And clinical information systems still remain primarily paper and neuron-based. Walk into any hospital, you're going to find a paper electronic record. And despite the availability of a lot of stuff online, ultimately the clinicians are still going to pull out a chart somewhere and turn to that chart, and that's going to be the primary way of sharing information. And I honestly think it's going to be that way for a long time. At least in the larger organizations. I don't think anyone is going to come up with a solid way to replace the medical record, I'm going to guess, for at least another 5 to 10 years. And I think the dream and the frustration is something we ought to have paper record, and the frustration we don't have it is something we ought to just get over, recognize that the paper record is where we'll be for a while, continue to develop it, but it's not something that we can expect anytime soon. Fragmentation, as I said, the development of all these systems in the world, in the world of healthcare, is growing, and we're developing that, and we're not moving to the day where we've got one single database, but we're moving to a world with many, many databases, and the challenge of sharing that information is becoming increasingly challenging for us. Community organizations, one of the other things, because so much development happened in the hospital, and major network development is being done in the hospital, and all of these other organizations that have grown up around it, the other organization, community-based organizations, still tend to be islands unto themselves and are not well integrated. And unfortunately, a lot of the providers and the ability to share information from community-based providers with the hospitals and among each other is a virtual impossibility. There are a couple projects. Cincinnati has a big project that's been in place for a couple of years. They're doing some few basic sharing of information. New York is just starting to look at a way to create a community health information network and share information among providers. But unfortunately, it's typically driven by the hospitals, and community-based providers are still left off on their own. I think there's tremendous opportunity with the internet and some of the dot-com potential that was raised in the late 1990s. But unfortunately, I think there's also a tremendous amount of cynicism, both in the investor community and in the user community. And I think it's going to be a while yet before we recuperate. We're starting to see a little bit of development of internet-based healthcare applications. But it's still pretty small compared to most industries, and I think it's going to take a while for the investor community to come back and want to reinvest in it. The other thing that I would point out, that it is very easy to kind of identify in some areas, you make an investment of what the improvement in a capital expenditure, this is going to have a particular return on investment. One of the things in my other class over this entire lecture is, how do you prove the return on investment of healthcare information systems? Very, very challenging, especially when you're trying to justify to a board that you're going to make a $6 million commitment in the new system. The board wants to know how quickly you're going to get that repaid. It's almost an impossibility, especially if it's a clinical information system. Very few of the systems create real savings. Very few of the systems create a return on investment that can be proven. I'd also say that one of the other legacies is that the PCs have proliferated, and the user familiarity, we all have a familiarity with PCs and comfortable with them, but are we really using them for much more than email and solitaire, some of the other games that people are playing? I love my PC, I love the email, I've got my BlackBerry, and I couldn't be anywhere without my BlackBerry at this point. But I can't tell you the last time I got on the PC and looked up any meaningful piece of information that meant something. I still will call up my finance department and say, you know, give me a report on X, Y, and Z. I haven't really figured out how to use the PC to get this information. Now, there are ways to do it. There's some people within my organization that can do it, including a couple of medical interns that figure out how to hack everything. But it is still primarily a place for me to do email. I have trouble with solitaire, and I don't play it much, but one of these days I will master it. And finally, the web is something that we've grown up in. Like every other industry, the web is really a very unregulated, unmanaged part of healthcare information, and it's true in healthcare as well. And we're living with that today. There is stuff on the web about cures for every disease, vitamin supplements and new therapies and the risks of things, and there is this vast unregulated web of information out there that is becoming a greater and greater challenge for us as providers to both understand and to combat, but to recognize that the way that healthcare evolved with the internet, the way this information has evolved, we weren't really responsible for putting a lot of the good information out there. We let other people do it and develop it. And we're living with the consequences today. And it is providing a real challenge for us, giving us some tremendous opportunity, I believe, to start sharing information, but at the same time creating a real opportunity for us to figure out what's good and what's bad information, unfortunately not delivering on the prospect of getting good information to us faster. What can you do about it? I just want to flip that to one last slide. Going ahead to the Okay. Couple of points. Number one, as you approach the issue of your healthcare information resources as a healthcare executive, a couple of things. Number one, what's your mission? Are you a hospital? Are you is your job to provide service to an inner city community, struggling inner city community? Are you a research-based organization? Know your mission and know your strategy before you go off and buy the technology. Too often we fall in love with a shiny computer system before we understand what we really need. And many, many healthcare organizations get themselves in trouble because they overspend. They buy a system that isn't well suited to their needs. Set expectations and be realistic. You know, software vendors will sell you a tremendous number of features that you will never implement. Having a real sense of what those expectations are. The job is to produce a good lab result and focus on producing a good lab result, not getting a system that will change the lighting in the room at the same time the doctor's trying to generate a result. Communicate, and that's the most important thing. People buy the systems, we turn to our IT folks and say, buy me a system that will do something. They go off and they buy it, they spend a year working on it, they develop it, they put it in place, and everybody looks at it and says, this isn't what we wanted. At every step along the way, communicating what you're doing, how you're doing it, and practicing good management of the process as you're implementing. And particularly your board, if you are an executive and you are responsible to a board, keep them involved, or your medical staff. I also believe you can't micromanage the people that are buying it. Sometimes people want it, whether it's an executive or a doctor, they want to tell the person that really has the talent, this is how I want to do it, and not let them create a system that will work for them. I think your goal really as the manager, articulate your need and articulate your expectations, but then allow them to figure out how to get there in the middle and manage them as you move it forward. We also need to make resources available. One of the biggest problems that we do is we buy the system, and then we don't, as the executive, we tell our information system folks, well, you spent $2 million on it, we're not going to give you the staff that need to be trained, we're not going to give you the PCs that need to be put on everybody's desk, we're not going to spend the money in the information network. Understand all of the resources that will be needed, and make sure that the resources are available to the folks that are responsible for implementing the system. And obviously, managing change is the most important. I find that most information systems failures in healthcare have nothing to do with the software's ability to do the job or the hardware's ability to do the job. It's the people that are going to be forced through the change of switching from either no automation to automation or one form of automation to another form of automation aren't being managed through that change. It's a very scary thing for most of the people that we're working with. And helping them through that change process, understanding the politics, understanding the fear they're approaching, the fear that they may lose their job if they don't know how to use the system, providing them the education and the coaching, and putting all of that in place is extremely important. And I also think that you need to set the pace. If you buy it, don't pay attention to it for 3 years, in 3 years it won't be implemented. If you buy it and you set up, you say, I want this thing implemented in 6 months, and then you meet schedule a meeting every week during those 6 months, it will move much faster than something you buy and leave on the shelf. And it sounds pretty simplistic, but creates a major difference in terms of what's created. And then finally, I think the other thing is to personify the organization's commitment. And the biggest challenge, I think, in healthcare is that the managers and the senior level people treat it like an unimportant resource. And one of the things that, if I can get any message across tonight, is that as you're moving into this industry, whether it's in management or clinical, if you treat the information unimportant, then you will get an unimportant information system and you'll get something that doesn't work. If you treat it as something that's important, and if you pay as much attention to it as you do to your human resources, and you pay as much attention to it as you do your finances, ultimately you will produce something that maybe isn't living up to all the promises of 10 years ago, but will produce some information and a system that's a lot better in terms of what you'll get if you're not paying attention to it. A lot of problems, a lot of opportunities in the industry. Anybody that's interested, there is still tremendous investment and a real need for talent, anybody that's interested in where their career may be going. And there's also a real opportunity, I think, for people that have some sense of the way healthcare organizations work to get a little bit of technical expertise and work with some of these companies on development of some of the products out there. So certainly something I encourage any of you to look into. I'm going to stop and open it up for any questions, and thank you for your attentiveness. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Can you offer your thoughts on the leadership role that hospitals should play in the implementation of healthcare IT? particularly electronic health records, personal health records?
I think the reality is, as I said, a lot of the real automation is happening outside of healthcare. But I think at least for the next 10, 20 years, hospitals need to be the primary drivers. And they are, while they're moving to the periphery, they are still the largest organizations in most communities. And frankly, the organizations with the most resource. And I think need to be the organizations that are driving the development of the record forward. Obviously, as I said, the most challenging organization to move forward from the development of a record. But I don't think they're going to have it.
As a follow-up question, do you have any thoughts on who should pay for it?
Who should pay for it? Yeah, I think there needs to be a reassessment, and certainly in hospitals, in terms of the amount of money that we're spending. When I came to Cabrini, our systems were a complete mess. We were able to fix them. We created something that's working, and we went from a sense of developing a system. Everybody wanted the Cadillac of systems at that point. And I would say probably what we've got right now is a well-functioning but stable Volkswagen. Probably, what's below the Passat, the next level down. But it runs well. And part of what we needed to do was make a commitment with the board that we're not going to underspend it every year. They were buying systems and not putting the money into maintaining it each year, and that required us to shift some resources, find some ways to refinance, and frankly, to shift money into more staffing, which meant some layoffs in some other parts of the organization, which wasn't very pleasant because no one was giving us additional information. We were able to grow some staffing and make a better commitment in some of that, so it's a little more stable, but we're still not there. But I think that healthcare needs to recognize that a bigger chunk of their annual operating budget should be spent. They're going to have to divert it from other parts of the organization. So there is some funding in some states. New York has this HEAL money. Nobody's figured out how to access yet, but there's a big program, about $1 billion, we're looking about making available for information systems. But I think ultimately it's going to be a shifting of priorities to make that money come available. Yes, sir.
In an ideal world, if money weren't an option, do you think there would still be an IT problem in healthcare?
No, I think there would still be a big problem. I think the problem in healthcare, part of it's money, a big part of it's money and the availability of money. But I think the more fundamental problem gets back to the way people view the information system and resource in healthcare. Like I said, bankers view it as a strategic resource. One of the things I'm worried about, honestly, with $1 billion of HEAL money right now, 5 years from now, it's going to evaporate, and we're going to be in as much trouble tomorrow, 5 years from now, than we are today with our systems, because I don't think the mindset is there yet in the management ranks, in the senior level ranks, that we need to approach the information resource from a fundamentally different perspective. We're going to view it the same way we view some other unimportant function, because we tend to get consumed with the politics of the organization, the clinical issues in the organization, and the information resource is something that we think about maybe once every 6 months. And I worry that the real issue isn't the money, it's the fact we're not paying attention to what we're doing with that money. Yes, ma'am.
How would you respond to clinicians who feel that electronic medical records are compromising?
It depends on the systems, I guess what I would say. I've not honestly seen too many systems that I think are working effectively in terms of augmenting the patient-provider relationship. In fact, I had an experience myself in the hospital where they put bedside terminals in every room. This is my son was hospitalized. And every time the nurse walked into the room, my son was over here, and she stood there like this. And I didn't feel that was really doing anything in terms of developing that relationship. And I know many providers feel the same way, that stick a computer screen between them is not helping. And frankly, it's putting distance between the provider and the patient. On the other hand, if you're talking to the patient, and you don't know that they've got an allergy to a particular drug, and you prescribe something for them, and you kill them, I would say that that information record is probably augmented. And I think part of it, and some of it's just the basic ergonomics and how the systems are used, the familiarity of the user with it, and frankly, the system's design. But I think that, I don't think it's an either or. I don't think given the complexity of delivering healthcare today, that a provider can know everything about a patient without having some sort of a tool available to them. And I think that's only going to increase over time. So the availability of that clinical information about the patient is something I think we should be putting in front of the provider. Hopefully the provider will have enough common sense to check it and then turn to the patient, frankly, and talk to the patient, not talk to the computer screen.
I got one over here.
Okay.
What do you think of the VA system? Just
in
PRS?
Actually, the VA system is probably the most successful system that's out there. And it's actually, you can buy it online, I think, for like $500 if you can find the programmers to run it. But again, it's the wonderful what government money can do. They put a lot of time and effort, and they really started development of an automated system many, many years ago. And they have a product that's probably the best thing out there right now in terms of integrating systems across all of the providers, both ambulatory and inpatient. And it is, I would say, the best system out there. It was also because they don't need to worry about billing. This is a fundamental difference. The VA, they don't need to worry. They built the system in the hospital. Most of the systems were built first for billing and then for clinical applications. One of the first ones that was really built around clinical information and has had 10 years now to really evolve.
And to follow that, I mean, I've been part of the school where you train at different places. And one of the problems at the VA because of that system was the distance that you felt. We had like team rooms and the interns, you know, everybody was in that room, but we felt like we were in that room most of the time because you would just see the patient in the morning and then you would have to be doing the orders and the notes and all the consults, you know, you would have to do it on the computer. So you spent most of your time in front of the computer
rather than the patient.
At the monitor. And then, you know, it seemed like it would add more. So I understand exactly what you're saying because I feel like it is, but I think there has to be that balance. And sometimes it's very difficult when you have a lot of patients to not have to spend so much time in front of the computer. But I would miss out, you know, you have to schedule meetings, things like that at separate times, and late in the day we would be there because of that. But then at the same time, it's the best resources because you are able to know about everything that's been going on in that patient. The minute they came into the hospital from outpatient and other hospitalizations, I thought that was like the best thing. It is paperless there. Like, there's nothing, we don't use paper for anything unless the computers aren't working, then you have to write the order.
Right. It's an area where I talked about the advent of wireless technology, and I think that will be very useful to us because part of the problem up until very recently was the only way to get access to the computer was to go where the PC is. And I think as wireless technology is evolving, and frankly as the the handheld technology is evolving, I think we will be able to get ourselves back in front of the patients. But it's still pretty crude, and there aren't really very many good products out there at this point that will free that up. We had an experience at Cabrini. We piloted a nurse documentation system, and we bought on one unit 15 of these rolling computers and put in a wireless system. And we were very excited because the nurse could, and we put the medication bins on this thing, and they could wheel it into the patient room and do their nurse documentation in the patient room. Thought it would give us more time with the nurses in the patient room and actually take advantage of the wireless technology. What we discovered within the first few days, the nurses were wheeling them all into a back room and doing them in the back room, and we asked why. And why do you think? What?
Your interruptions.
No, that was a little bit, not the real reason.
Interference.
We don't want to look stupid in front of the patients typing this stuff in. They had so many questions on how to use it, and it wasn't a very friendly system. So it was a lot easier to talk to the patient and write down a couple of notes and then go back and hear it. And they didn't want to sit there making mistakes in front of the patient. That's a pretty human issue that we hadn't anticipated. And no one wants to be put in that situation, especially when somebody's health is at risk. And it's just so much easier to have that FaceTime rather than sit there and fuss with the computer. And the technology, frankly, we cammed the pilot. we decided that the technology just was not simplistic enough, frankly, for people to use in those areas. We redeployed them in our operating room, actually, where the patient is anesthetized and nobody worries about it. The patient is not quite watching to make mistakes.
Listen, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay. We'll take a short break and we can go have some brownies or cookies outside to support the Gulf Coast, I think. And then when we come back, I'm going to hand back your papers, the memos, and then we're going to talk more about public health and emergency preparedness. That's right. Okey-doke. What I want to do in 7:30,
this one a little bit longer than I thought, and I want to let you go. Let me hold these papers together here.
I want to spend just a little while, maybe half hour or so, talking with you a little bit more about emergency preparedness and public health, the conversation that we started last week, and just didn't finish. And then next week, again, we're going to have Eric Rose starting out talking about quality of care, particularly, he's the head of surgery department here at Presbyterian, talking about some of the kinds of things they're trying to do here to improve surgery. And then, and something of an ironic twist, I'm going to talk a little about medical malpractice in the second half. And then we'll have Jeff Sachs on May 1st, we'll talk about comparative health.
But let me say one thing. I know a number of you have just picked up your papers, memo two. I think some of you did really well on memo two. Others of you, I think, found that ERISA was a tricky subject and might not have done as well as you'd hoped. The grades were a little bit lower in general on the second memo than the first. I'm happy, the teaching assistants are happy to talk to you if they've graded your paper. I'm happy to talk to you if I graded your paper or even if I didn't grade your paper, and just sort of let you know what we were looking for in the papers. And again, it's just a small part of the grade, so don't think anybody should be panicking or getting too upset. But if you have any concerns about, if now that you've done two memos and you have some concerns on how you've done on both, and you want to chat before writing the third memo and before writing the term paper, again, feel free to contact either the teaching assistants or myself. We're all happy to talk. Okay. Last week, I talked a little about how public health, in many respects, is the stepchild of the American healthcare system. Ever since we've really developed a institutional-based, specialist-based healthcare system, ever since we made a conscious effort to, increase the number of specialists, to increase the number of hospitals, to increase funding for medical research, we've had a sort of simultaneous decrease in the respect and in the funding that we give the public health system, public health and population-based health here in the United States. And I think that's an important fact for you pretty much all. I mean, there may be one or two seeker or social work or business students who snuck into this class, but most of you are public health students. You're entering a career in public health yourself. And I think it's important to have a sense of what the role of public health is in the American healthcare system, what the role of schools of public health are, and how we can think about shifting and changing it. In 1984, as a nation, we spent about $10 billion on public health. In 2004, and that's 2004, 3 years after September 11th, 2001, we spent $56 billion on public health. And that's in a healthcare system that spends over $2 trillion a year right now. Less than 3% of our spending, I mean maybe 4% was around 2%, now it's around 3%. between 2 and 3% of our spending is on public health-based services, population-based services. Very, very small stepchild of the healthcare system. And yet, while it's a small stepchild of the healthcare system, as you know, or as you should know, having now spent most of you at least a year in medical school, some of you more, public health is extraordinarily important to the healthcare system and is extraordinarily important to the health of the nation. So, point one I want to emphasize tonight, once again to you, is that public health historically, and particularly in the last 50, 60 years, has been the stepchild of the American healthcare system. Point two is that emergency preparedness, whether it's to a natural disaster such as Katrina, whether it's to a terrorist attack such as the anthrax or the World Trade Center attacks in 2001, whether it's natural or whether it's man-made, emergency preparedness has long been the stepchild of the public health system. So, I mean, really, you know, you've got very little attention paid to public health generally. And then within public health, emergency preparedness is at the absolute bottom of the totem pole. I don't actually have the figures. I don't know the numbers. They're not recorded. But if we spent in 2004 $56 billion on public health in a $2 trillion healthcare system, if public health agencies and public health departments spent $56 billion in the year 2004, my guess would be maybe $4 or $5 billion of that $56 billion was spent on emergency preparedness. And that $4 or $5 billion is the amount of money that the federal government has kicked into state and local governments in the last few years to do emergency preparedness activities. Emergency preparedness has truly been the forgotten stepchild of public health. What have public health departments done in recent years? Well, they've done important things. You know, public health departments have tried to ensure the quality of food systems and the water systems and the sewage systems. They've tried to monitor disease, natural disease outbreaks. They've tried to send, you know, the few epidemiologists, and there are way too few epidemiologists, but the few epidemiologists that we have into the field to track and to monitor patterns of disease. They've tried to do some public health education. They tried to have some immunization campaigns. You know, they tried to do some of the kinds of things you know about. They've also, as we talked about last week, spent, and again, I don't have a good breakdown on it, but I would bet you that over half of that $56 billion was spent on direct care of services. You know, running primary care clinics, running clinics for the mentally ill, the substance abusers, and the TB clinics, the HIV clinics, and the family planning clinics, but providing direct healthcare services has probably been the number one spender in public health. And then you've got sort of your traditional, your normal public health activities, and then at the very, very bottom of the totem pole is emergency preparedness. Now, prior to 2001, when there was a hurricane, when there was an earthquake, who responded? Who dealt with the consequences of that earthquake or that fire or that hurricane? Was it public health departments? No. It was fire departments. It was police departments. It was emergency medical trained EMTs. And in the background somewhere, perhaps, would be a rep from the local public health department, but they were truly not the first responders. And if the hurricane was so significant, so devastating, that the local officials, that even the state officials felt they couldn't handle it, it was overwhelming to them, to whom would they turn? They would turn to the federal government. And to whom in the federal government would they turn? Well, prior to 1979, they would turn to Congress and they would turn to the president and say, we're overwhelmed, could you give us some money, you know, to help us out?
And on an ad hoc basis, 100, 150 times, the federal government gave local communities and states not public health departments, but they gave local emergency first responders, firemen, policemen, etc., funding, money. But there was no organized federal activity to support that kind of effort either. There was no federal emergency medical response, no federal emergency preparedness at all on other than an ad hoc basis prior to 1979. 1979, Jimmy Carter creates FEMA, the Federal Emergency, I can't even remember what the last MA stands for. Management what? Agency. Sorry. Creates FEMA. And FEMA becomes the federal agency that's supposed to help the state and local first responders when they're overwhelmed. And in 1993, Bill Clinton says, FEMA's really important, and he elevates FEMA to a cabinet-level position. And FEMA all of a sudden is a cabinet-level position, reporting directly to the president. Again, though, FEMA and state and local first responders respond to hurricanes, respond to earthquakes, respond to natural disasters, but they do it essentially without the public health community. They do it essentially without the healthcare community more generally. They do it without the hospitals. They do it without the doctors. The effort is to deal with the crisis of the moment, to get people some emergency housing, to get people some insurance money, to get people, to clear the debris and the trees away from the front yard, and to get sort of a return to normalcy. And that's the emergency preparedness system we have. That's emergency preparedness federalism. State and local health departments. Now, in theory, emergency preparedness should always have been a part of the public health agenda. I mean, geez, if there's a hurricane, if there's an earthquake, if there's, an infectious disease that's spreading through a bioterrorist attack, I mean, who else other than public health departments should be very much integrally involved in that? But again, not on the agenda. Public health, as I said, started out as a stepchild with very little money, very little prestige, a very small place at the table. 2001, the various attacks take place. And in New York City, the New York City Health Department, and I think much more so, by all accounts, let me put it this way, the New York City Health Department was much more integrally involved in the response activities right after the attacks on September 11th than was the Washington, D.C. and the Virginia Health Departments. They were involved, but did not have it was much more traditional first responders there. In New York City, given the size of the health department, given the fact that the New York City Health Department is probably bigger and more sophisticated than the other 2,999 health departments put together in this country, they responded effectively. And Congress began to realize, and the president began to realize, and states began to realize that, geez, if there is a bioterror attack, if there is an emergency, if there is a crisis, we might need health departments. We might need them to take a role. So again, as we talked a little bit about last week, Congress over the last 5 years has allocated about $5 billion to state and local health departments to do emergency preparedness activities. Congress has also allocated about $2-3 billion to hospitals. The hospitals to try to figure out how they're going to respond and how they're going to be helpful if there's a crisis, if there's an emergency. I had you read some reports from the Trust for America and from various groups on how that money has been spent. And there have been some pros and some cons, some pluses and some minuses, some ups and some downs. I mean,
clearly state and local health departments in general are a bit better prepared or a bit better off today than they were in 2000 when it comes to emergency preparedness. Most of them have hired a bioterror preparedness person within the organization. They've got a nice plan now on the books, which they may or may not follow if anything happens, but they have a nice plan on the books. Maybe they've done a drill. You know, FEMA started to do a drill as to what they would do if there was a hurricane in New Orleans, a dramatic, tragic hurricane in New Orleans, well before Katrina actually hit. Anybody know what happened to that FEMA drill? Yeah.
They went through part of it, but they never were able to, complete it.
They ran out of money.
Right.
So they never finished the drill. And that's sort of the state of emergency preparedness at FEMA and at most health departments around the country. Again, there's the beginning of an effort. There was the beginning of an effort at FEMA to think about hurricanes in a place like New Orleans. But there's not enough money, there's not enough infrastructure, there's not enough resources, there's just not enough in place. Now, I want to just talk about two sort of mini case studies in the last couple of years, post 9/11. First is the smallpox vaccination effort, and the second is Katrina. Those, I think, have been sort of the two test cases, you might say, for sort of emergency preparedness in the public health system in the last couple of years. Now, the last time there was a smallpox infectious breakout in the United States was when? Does anybody know? In 1947. I believe, here in New York City. A couple of people died, some other people got sick. And basically, within a month or month and a half period, over 6 million people were vaccinated here in the New York area. But the vaccination back then, just as today, was not without side effects, was not without complications. And in fact, it led to some deaths and some adverse reactions, of course. So along comes the end of 2002. And the administration is planning a war in Iraq, there's a war going on in Afghanistan, and there's tremendous fears that there's going to be a smallpox terrorist attack on the United States. So the president goes to his folks at CDC and he says, what should we do? You know, to plan and prepare for smallpox attack. And the CDC says, let's give the vaccination to 15,000 healthcare workers across the country. And that way, if there is an attack, those 15,000 healthcare workers who voluntarily agreed, you know, to be vaccinated and to take the lead, they can then start vaccinating everybody else and help everybody else if there's an actual attack later on, because they'll already be immunized, be inoculated. But the White House doesn't like that plan, for better or for worse. And the White House in December of 2002, when was that going to happen? In December of 2002, the White House decides it wants a much larger, significantly larger vaccination effort. In fact, they want phase one, they want the first couple of months, they want 500,000 healthcare workers vaccinated. And in what they call phase two, a few months down the line, they want 10 million first responders vaccinated. So basically, they want about 10.5 million folks vaccinated. So that's the directive that's beginning to come out of the White House. Now, on emergency preparedness, by the time we get to 2002, 2003,
this is actually one of the messages that I want to try to get across. There is extraordinary, and this still exists today, 2006, extraordinary bureaucratic, organizational fighting going on at all sorts of levels. Part of the fighting that's going on is going on because after 2001, remember I said that Congress decided they were going to give out Congress decided they were going to give about $5 billion, you know, about $1 billion a year to state local health departments, and they would give, you know, some money to local hospitals. Well, that money was all going to go through the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. The money for state and local health departments was going to go through the CDC, and the money for hospitals was going to go through another HHS department called HRSA. I don't remember what that stands for really. But it basically, they help hospitals and community health centers and other organizations. So the unit within HHS to take care of that. But at the same time that Congress decides to allocate that money for healthcare needs, for emergency preparedness, healthcare needs through HHS, Congress and the President also are creating, what are they creating? The Department of Homeland Security. And Tom Ridge, former governor of Pennsylvania, is appointed first Secretary of Homeland Security. So by the time we get to 2003 and the period of the sort of smallpox vaccination, and this is going to take us all the way up to 2005 and Katrina, by the time we get to 2003, there's unbelievable bureaucratic infighting going on. FEMA, which is in 2000 and was given, you know, by Clinton sort of independent status in 1993 as an independent agency under the Department of Homeland Security Act, it loses its status as an independent cabinet level agency, and it is put into and becomes part of the Department of Homeland Security. At the same time, there's big battles over where various functions around healthcare should be placed. For example, there's something called the National Medical Disaster System, which is a system which has several thousand doctors and healthcare providers on call, you know, in a moment's notice, in theory, to be placed at the scene of disasters, volunteers. That system had been in HHS, Department of Health and Human Services. When the Department of Homeland Security takes over FEMA, that National Medical Disaster System is put into the Department of Homeland Security. It's taken out of HHS, and it's put in Homeland Security, and it's put under FEMA. So FEMA loses its independence as a cabinet-level agency, but it gets some programs like that. But at the same time, FEMA loses tremendous amounts of dollars and bureaucratic responsibilities to other entities within the Department of Homeland Security. Basically, FEMA is no longer to be a preparedness agency, it's simply to be a response agency. Michael Brown, the director, the head of FEMA, again, this is sort of jumping ahead a little bit to the Katrina story. Michael Brown was so embroiled in battles, ongoing battles with Ridge and then with Chirkoff, the new head of Department of Homeland Security. He had already not only lost most of his key staff by the summer of 2005, but he had already decided that on Labor Day he was going to resign and put in his resignation. But of course, Katrina hit. Well, he ended up designing shortly after that day. But Katrina hit. No. So let me go back to smallpox. So as I said, there were these tremendous infighting battles going on between Health and Human Services and Homeland Security and FEMA at the federal level. And I cannot overstate to you, these battles resulted in tremendous loss of staff. Tremendous loss of staff, tremendous loss of dollars, tremendous loss of morale. You know, huge infighting going on. And this kind of bureaucratic infighting has its impact, has its impact. That's within the federal government. Within the states, there's huge battles going on over this $5 billion that's being divvied up. And again, I think we talked a little bit last week about, you know, the debate over whether or not money should be divided up based on population, in effect, or based on risk. You know, whether or not Nebraska should get a per capita amount of money higher than New York, or whether or not it should all be allocated. Huge interstate battles going on over this money. And not only were there battles going on between the 50 states, but within each state, there were battles going on between state and local officials. Because the local health departments were basically saying to the states, we want the money. We're where the rubber hits the road. We're the organization that's really going to be the first responder. You know, the feds aren't going to be the, you know, the, I mean, the way if an infectious disease breaks out, it's going to be noticed first by some doc in some hospital who notices a pattern. You know, 2-3 people walk in with similar symptoms that seem odd, that seem peculiar, that seem unusual, and they call up a local health department official and then they run some tests, you know, and then it sort of works its way up the food chain. So the local counties are saying, we want the money. So huge political battles going on between counties and state governments and between the counties themselves. Okay, so President Bush decides in the end of 2002 that he wants, you know, 500,000 healthcare workers vaccinated immediately against smallpox, another 10 million within a few months. When the program ended about a year later, how many people had been vaccinated? Anybody have a guess? 37,000. Instead of 10.5 million, it was 37,000. There was huge battles, huge opposition, huge fighting. What were some of the issues? Why do you think the smallpox initiative was so controversial? Why do you think there was such tremendous resistance? What were some of the issues? Anybody know? Yeah.
Like the fact that based on, like, in 1947, we had all these people getting vaccinated here in New York, that I think the risks might have been an issue too, in terms of putting people at risk of death for something that they felt that, I don't know if you get so many people vaccinated.
I mean, some people said, you know what? There are safety issues involved in this vaccination. There are side effects, plus there's potential, you know, serious adverse health consequences for some, particularly to those who have a history of cardiac or immune system problems more generally. So there are risks involved, safety, health risks involved. On the other hand, what was the real threat? You know, in 1947, and that was, you know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, in 1947, there was an outbreak of smallpox in New York City. A couple of people died. Bang, 6 million people got inoculated. There was some trouble, but then it was over. Now, so everybody knew the risk then. I mean, then there really was a potential serious outbreak. Now, there was fear, concern, that there was going to be this bioterror smallpox attack. And, you know, the Russians had some smallpox that they hadn't gotten rid of, and we had some smallpox, and some terrorists can get a hold of it, and some Saddam Hussein was going to get a hold of it, and the whole world was going to be attacked by this. But those were actually serious fears at the time, concerns among some. But among others would have said, you know what, if there were real safety concerns. What other kind of concerns do you think there were? Remember, I'm counting to 7 after those two.
Was it still for healthcare providers only?
Well, the first phase, the first 500,000 would be healthcare providers. The next 10 million would be cost finding another person.
Maybe they're afraid of this kind of opposition, like big type of bioterrorism attack, and they have to serve the public and not their own family.
Well, there were always concerns about what this would mean, you know, what sort of obligations people were taking on. Sure. Yeah.
Oh,
Well, some people, well, you know, the flip side of the fact that there were safety concerns and that people might get sick, the flip side is some people were concerned, well, what if they gave an inoculation and somebody died, you know, from the inoculation they gave them? Seriously, would they be sued? Would they be liable? What sort of liability would there be, you know, to the person who actually was giving the inoculation? What sort of legal protections would there be, if any? What about work? I mean, even if everything goes well with most of these inoculations, it's pretty common that you sort of don't feel so good for a few days. So, and that's a best case scenario. So a lot of people would be taking a few days off from work, and even if you didn't get really, really sick, you know, you could still miss a week or two weeks of work. Who is going to pay for all the lost wages and all the lost potential work time? Who is going to pay for the whole, you know, to inoculate 10.5 million people more generally? Is it going to be local health departments? Was it going to be the Nassau County Health Department? It actually costs a lot of money and a lot of resources and a lot of time and a lot of effort to put together that kind of huge vaccination program. So there were liability issues, there were union issues, there were safety issues, there were cost issues. There were issues about how serious the threat was, there was poor communication, and there was resistance. The CDC, for example, was making it pretty clear to state and local health officials that they considered the smallpox vaccination program to be voodoo public health. That it just wasn't necessary, you know, and sort of the undercurrent message was, you know, the White House is making us do this. You know, we don't think it's a great idea, but you've got to go ahead and do it. So there was tremendous opposition. There were also, I mentioned to you last week, the health commissioner in Seattle claims that he had to divert so much of, early on, so much attention to the smallpox vaccination initiative that they missed the TB outbreak in Seattle. And that took them a lot longer to get control of this TB outbreak in Seattle. And so there was a complaint that this was causing this federal mandate, this federal White House mandate from the perspective of the Seattle Health Commissioner, was causing a diversion of resources away from what he considered his traditional public health function with adverse consequences. So basically, there was essentially a boycott in much of the country of the program. One of the consequences of that is that relationships between counties, states, and federal officials sour even more. And ultimately, the feds pulled the plug on the initiative and said, all right, we have 37,000 inoculated now, that's enough. You know, we can, if there's an outbreak, we can use those 37,000 to start out. We don't need 500,000. But basically, it pulled the plug on it, and a lot of the money, though, that had been, a lot of that bioterror preparedness money that state and local counties got in 2002, 2003, they ended up spending on smallpox, even though they felt that wasn't where they wanted to spend. So that's one sort of case study. Another quick case study, and I'll let you go soon. I usually like to let you go on 8. I'll just go for a few more minutes. Another case study is Katrina. Yeah, question.
Why are all these cities, states, waiting for federal money
The question was, why haven't state and local counties previously been, you know, spending any money on emergency preparedness and health costs? Anybody have a thought?
Where's the money?
You're
talking about Katrina. I mean, that's
the
example of where
it's coming. We're about to get to Katrina. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a good question. You know, as I said, the reason I started out by saying, you know, public health is a stepchild of the healthcare system and emergency preparedness is a stepchild of the public health system is because I think it's just true. I think emergency health departments have just really always placed a very low priority, a very low agenda on emergency preparedness activities, either because they thought somebody else would do it, you know, either the states or FEMA or you know, somebody else, or because they were so strapped for money they felt like they didn't have the money to do it, or because it was simply, you know, we'd never been attacked. You know, people didn't really consider the 1993 attack on the Trade Center or the 95 attack by McVeigh at Oklahoma City in the same way. So, you know, there was a sense that we weren't at risk, and that we weren't at risk at least for a bioterror attack, and that when it came to things like hurricanes and natural disasters, there were other people doing it. I mean, I don't really have an answer to your question. I don't have an answer to it. Well, let's look at Katrina for a second. Let's talk about Katrina for a second. I mean, as I said, by the time Katrina hits in August of 05, the end of August of 05, the emergency preparedness systems at the federal level were a mess. I mean, Michael Brown was writing letters and memos to Ridge and then to Chirkov saying, we've been stripped of money, we've been stripped of staff, we're unprepared. We tried to do a drill on New Orleans, and this was before Katrina, we ran out of money. You know, we're just totally unprepared. There were studies and reports done on this National Disaster Medical System in which basically the docs, again, before Katrina, said, you know what, if there's a disaster, we're just not prepared. You know, we just don't have the systems in place. Federal level wasn't prepared at all. At the state level, Louisiana and New Orleans, again, before Katrina, there's a group that ranks the 50 states, the health status and the healthcare systems of the 50 states in the United States. It comes out with the ranking. I think Minnesota always ends up number one or whatever, but there's a ranking of the 50 states. What number do you think Louisiana was ranked?
50.
Louisiana is consistently the lowest rank, and this is on things like infant mortality rates, you know, homicide rates, cancer rates, rates of, you know, heart disease, you know, percentage of doctors to population, number of uninsured. You know, this sort of the whole, again, it's not a scientific ranking system, but Louisiana was considered to have the worst healthcare system in the nation. Louisiana also ranked number three in the nation in percentage of its residents who are uninsured. Only Texas and New Mexico had more uninsured. And that's largely because Texas and New Mexico had large numbers of immigrants who came in, particularly undocumented immigrants who didn't have insurance. You know, as compared to Louisiana, which had fewer. But in terms of, you know, the number of uninsured, the other body. Public insurance system, Louisiana had one of the least generous public insurance, least generous Medicaid programs in the country. Again, this is pre-Katrina. Medicaid eligibility levels for adults. Remember, the feds set the eligibility levels for kids with those mandates we talked about way at the beginning of the system, way at the beginning of the semester. The state set them for adults. Louisiana had one of the lowest Medicaid eligibility levels for adults in the country. Private health insurance rates, Louisiana had one of the lowest rates in the country, you know, for employer-sponsored private health insurance. Local health department effectiveness and efficiency, Louisiana, New Orleans was rated one of the lowest in the country, one of the worst in the country. The healthcare system in New Orleans, and this is important for thinking about the future of New Orleans. The healthcare system in New Orleans was completely dominated by a number of hospitals, particularly charity, you know, particularly large public hospitals. Louisiana ranked first in the nation in the percentage of disproportionate share of Medicaid dollars its hospitals got from Medicaid. And that's because it has such a Medicaid hospital-driven system. As a result of that, it had one of the lowest rates, one of the fewest numbers of community health centers and sort of public health clinics in the country. So very few primary care docs, very few public health clinics, very few community health centers, and lots of big public hospitals that low-income folks, uninsured folks, and middle-class folks basically got all their health care from. So then Katrina hits. And again, I mean, we don't have time. I think some of you have even been down to New Orleans on different trips. I know a number of public health students have gone down there. You know, I don't have to repeat to you how everything that could have gone wrong went wrong, but it went wrong at every level of government and at every level of public and private system. Whether it was the complete chaos at the federal level, to the complete chaos at the state level, to the complete chaos at the local level, to the fact that the hospitals, again, this hospital-driven system, all of a sudden was knocked out of business. The National Disaster Medical System tried to bring in several thousand docs pretty quickly to New Orleans. Those docs ended up stranded in Texas, waiting for instructions on where to go for over a week. The system just fell apart. And to tell you the truth, I have a friend that just got back from New Orleans last week. It's still falling apart. I mean, much of New Orleans is as bad today as it was in September of 2005. It was just last week that FEMA came out with some regulations on, you know, the building of sort of new homes and people. I mean, it's a total catastrophe. So one, and in terms of the healthcare system, it essentially fell apart. It just fell apart. There were some efforts that were made. I mean, you know, the Medicaid program, for example, gave waivers to 17 states so that in 17 states, evacuees who had been on Medicaid or who were eligible for Medicaid could get Medicaid coverage in those other states right away. Or if he was still in Louisiana, you can get a temporary Medicaid card if they lost the card. So there were some efforts that over time began to take place. But the system as a whole fell apart. So the question, well, a couple of questions. Number one, one question is, as people try to think about rebuilding in New Orleans and Louisiana, one question that's coming up a lot now is what kind of healthcare system do you want to rebuild? Do you want to rebuild a hospital-centric, hospital-dominated system such as the one they had beforehand? Or do you want to build more of a community-based, clinic-based healthcare system? Bigger picture, though, who should be making decisions about a place like New Orleans, about a state like Louisiana? How much local discretion? And this is really... and these are the questions I want to leave you with. They're really federalism questions. You know, here we have a system. Now, again, if Katrina hit in other places, and there was devastation in other places, Mississippi and other places, terrible devastation. If Katrina had hit in New York City, I mean, obviously it's hard to compare exactly, but if you had the New York City Health Department and the New York State Health Department in place, things would have been, they would have been different. I think there's no question about that. But that raises the question of how do you think about federal, state, and local relationships? Do those relationships vary by some federal or some, you know, independent, nonpartisan ranking of the adequacy of the state and local infrastructures? Does the federal government say we have different responses in different places? Maybe. Is it up to local communities to really just build their own systems, and when their own systems fall apart, you know, they can't really blame anybody else for that? I mean, these are all, you know, what sort of relationships, what sort of emergency preparedness system should we have in this country? I mean, since 2001, we never really discussed this as a country, you know, explicitly or implicitly before 2001. And since 2001, or really since 2002, near the end of 2001, beginning of 2002, since 2002, we've had this sort of mad scramble in which we've been, you know, I don't want to say throwing money, but we've been spending a lot of money in certain places trying to build up emergency preparedness systems. There have been some marginal improvements, but the system is still a mess. I mean, are we ready now? And this includes New York City, too. I mean, the World Trade Center, as horrible as it was, 3,000 lives were lost, and it was, you know, I mean, I know people who were killed. You know, I mean, it was, you can't imagine a more horrible thing. But it sort of happened, and it was over. It wasn't an ongoing. It's not as if, I mean, I was just reading this afternoon as I was getting ready for class, you know, somebody who was giving a talk in which they were saying, you know, as everybody fled the World Trade Center, you know, everybody who'd been in the building in the neighborhood that morning, and they were sort of filled with dust, you know, from the dust that was just pouring out from the buildings and everything. What if that dust had been contaminated in some respects? So as they were spreading out across New York City and going home, they had been potentially infecting people all over the place. You know, would New York City have been prepared for that? No. If you talk to, I mean, Isaac Weisfuss, who basically runs the New York City infectious disease programs at the health department and its disaster management program, you know, he's a graduate of our program here. And so we've spoken to him. And, you know, New York City is far ahead of a lot of other places. But is New York City truly ready for a full-scale emergency? I mean, can you be ready for a full-scale emergency? How should you begin to think about, you know, there's a lot of talk. In fact, it's amazing the way the ups and downs of this go. 6 months ago, you couldn't open a newspaper. You couldn't turn on the TV station without reading about the avian flu and the pandemic flu, and the whole world was going to fall apart because 90 million people were going to be infected by this flu. All of a sudden, it's off the radar screen now. It's just, I mean, has the possibility of, you know, a pandemic flu disappeared? No. Has the federal government put in place a real plan to prepare for a possible pandemic flu? No. Are states and local governments ready? No. Are drug companies, do they have an economic incentive or a financial incentive to produce large amounts of vaccine? No. Do they know what kind of vaccine to produce? No. These are questions that are really have been, for the last 3-4 years, we've been struggling with, and we don't have answers to. We don't know what level of government should do what. We don't know how to prepare for emergencies. These are things that are new on the agenda. And I think public health departments, public health students, and public health schools, you know, and folks like you are the folks who have to really, if anybody is going to be thinking about these things, if anybody's going to be thinking about planning and getting involved in planning, it's going to have to be, to a large extent, you know, folks like you and folks like me. Anyway, I have a couple of things I want to do, but it can wait. I mean, it's the bottom line is, you know, there are real issues of politics, real issues of federalism, real issues of organizational relationships, real issues of bureaucracy, real issues of priorities, and these are open issues right now. And just as I sort of, when we had the lecture and the talk on long-term care last week, and I was saying, you know, the long-term care system is a mess, and it's, and this is great. We had, you know, Bob was talking about health information technology, you know, it's a mess, and, you know, we don't do anything. You know, that's the theme. I think, you know, if you go off and think about what a mess everything is, you'll be better off. All right, that's enough today. Anybody who didn't pick up their memo, too, we still have them down somewhere around.